is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Tuesday, March 19th, 2024. And today will be better than yesterday. I'm Buster Olney. I'm back in Montana today after 2 weeks in Florida. Adrian Zulueta. It's a beautiful name, Adrian, and I want to make sure that I pronounce it right. She's working from California. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well, Buster. Had a late night for Selection Sunday, but I'm glad to be here with you.
Is your bracket done?
Absolutely not, but I'm a little bit closer. I got probably, I know my final four based on what Reese and Pete talked about on their College Game Day pod.
Oh, really? Who you got?
UConn seems to be the favorite of everyone. And then Houston, Tennessee, and I can't remember the different regions, but I know that Pete really likes Arizona. So maybe I'll pick them.
See, I can't pick Tennessee because I went to Vanderbilt and they're our rival, so I can't do that. But the most important thing is that I beat my – we have like a friends and family type bracket going on, and yeah. I have to beat my son because he's talking all kinds of smack.
Got to set him straight.
And when I'm done the podcast taping with you, I'm going right to the bracket study, going to call experts. Jake doesn't know that I have a lot of experts at my disposal at ESPN.
Oh, yes. But also, sometimes you got to go with your gut. You never know how that's going to work out.
Well, last year didn't work out so well. I picked Montana State, and they took me down. They got blown out in the first game, and Montana State won their the conference tournament the other day. They're in the tournament. I'm not doing that again.
Maybe this year it'll work out.
You know, my partner works at Montana State, and I'm curious to see which way she goes with all that. All right, we are less than 24 hours from the first game of the season. The Dodgers and Padres are getting ready for those games that'll be broadcast on ESPN Wednesday and Thursday mornings East Coast time. They actually start about 5:30 East Coast time. Gavin Stone pitched for the Dodgers in an exhibition. And again, he was totally dominant. He's looked great this spring. He got news from Dodgers manager Dave Roberts. Here's Stone and Roberts speaking after that game.
I'm incredibly thankful for that and the opportunity that they're giving me. Very appreciative and look forward to taking advantage of it. This just goes back to, you know, the work that I put in the offseason, fine-tuning some stuff, gaining some more control, gaining some more confidence, better mound presence, and then you tie all that together and hopefully it's a good recipe and hopefully we can ride it all year long.
I think the thing that stands out most with Gavin is maturity. I think when you see a young player, you can tell things speed up and, you know, now it just seems like things have slowed down for him. There's much more consistent execution.
The Padres' Ha-Seong Kim had a great moment playing in his homeland.
1-2 pitch is driven in the air to deep left field. Back goes Moon at the wall. It is gone. Ha-Seong Kim returns to Korea and hits a home run. 2-run shot for Kim.
Yes, it is. And he is awesome. You bet.
Yeah, so he hit a home run in his first plate appearance back in South Korea. Michael Taylor signed with the Pittsburgh Pirates, 1 year, $4 million, one of the few veterans still left on the board. I think since the last podcast, Adam Duvall signed a 1 year, $3 million deal to be part of a platoon for the Atlanta Braves. The interesting part about that for me was the fact that the Braves have decided, you know what? Jared Kelnick is not someone we want to have taking all the at-bats in left field, so they're going to just have him platoon. Yankees ace Gerrit Cole spoke with reporters since the last podcast and indicated to them that he will not be throwing for 3 to 4 weeks. According to Cole, I think we've determined that we just got a little too hot, a little too quick. We're going to be talking with Stefania Bell, ESPN's injury expert, about what we heard from Cole and about the information that we get from teams and from pitchers and how much we should take them at face value. It looks like Cole's going to start the year on the 60-day injured list and then return sometime maybe in June. The Reds, a big injury the other day. Center fielder TJ Friedl is out indefinitely due to a broken wrist. We'll get more information on that as we move forward about how long he's going to be out. I mentioned the Braves, what's going on in left field. In their rotation, they've optioned Bryce Elder to the minor leagues. Ronaldo Lopez has won the competition for the number 5 spot, which really shouldn't be a surprise. He's got a great arm. I saw him pitch this spring. This winter, he signed a 3-year, $30 million deal. might be one of those hybrid roles where he, for a time, he's a starting pitcher and then he shifts into the bullpen later in the year. Adrian, what else you got?
Well, as everyone knows, Buster has been doing all of these great team previews and has on such amazing guests. If you missed it, he did a great one with Albert Pujols back on March 7th, where they talk about Pujols as a manager and how he would use analytics in the game. And I'm going to make one quick shout out to my colleague, Sean, who did do that College Game Day podcast for March Madness. Definitely look that up on Spotify or wherever you get your pods.
Doug Glanville played in the major leagues, and he's an analyst for ESPN now. He also teaches at UConn. You seem like you do everything, Doug, right? And I feel like that the fact that you are a professor at UConn, or you teach at UConn, it's going to have some bearing on how you fill out your NCAA bracket based on the story you told us before. Yes?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and, you know, I have a class, and last year I taught the same class at about 52, 53 students. And I kind of knew, like, well, you know, UConn's doing pretty well. And I happened to be doing a game, I think, in Houston when they're at the Final Four. So I was like, I might catch the team on the road. Some of my students were, like, student managers. So we were all in touch and, you know, keeping in touch on the chaos. And then it timed out. We're like, wait a minute, they could win. And I was like, are they going to come to class tomorrow? So when they won out of the 53, five out of 53 showed up, like five. So I was like, I got to give them extra credit or something. I got to do something. So, but it was fun. We ended up talking about Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese and LSU. And so it was a very good discussion. So that was, you know, the bonus content of that day. So hopefully this year, if it goes down again, maybe I get 10 out of 50 this time.
So how did you handle that as an instructor? Like, did you wind up getting demerits for the 48 who didn't come in, or did you give just the extra credit for the five who did?
Yeah, I did the positive thing. I said, let me give credit. I mean, you shouldn't get credit for showing up, but I figured it was...
In this case.
In this case, yeah. And it was fun. We just had a fun class because we could really dive into issues. So the big thing was women's basketball. So we got into that. Like, should Paige Becker stay, which she decided, Caitlin Clark. So we had a lot of fun with the hoops story that comes out of UConn outside of the fact that they won. So I was always like, well, where were you when they won kind of thing? So... yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's fun being on campus because, you know, they just have some really good teams. And so we always have plenty to talk about when it comes to current events.
The current events this week, the first games of the Major League Baseball regular season. We've got the Padres. We've got the Dodgers. You and I are obviously back here in the States. It feels like everything coming out of Korea is super fun and super positive. It really does look like the players are having a great time. What are you seeing?
Yeah, and it's so great for the game. I mean, we have an international game, and there's so many players and more hailing from Korea, different parts of the world. The game's trying to just expand in a sense of just giving the exposure and also just acknowledging the traditions and history that shape a lot of the players that do end up playing in Major League Baseball. So the more you can open these doors, and I mean, I think of, you know, the Negro League series coming, you know, and these are just important recognitions of history, where the game comes from, and also how you shape going forward. And when you saw that joy, you know, it doesn't matter where you're coming from, you could come together and use sport as something that you can elevate as a great example for larger society. You know, that's what I teach in my class. And I think baseball is, you know, really showcasing that on the world stage.
You know, what's really cool is to watch Ohtani have so much fun, because it felt like in the last few years, you'd go to the, you know, cover an Angels game, and he wasn't accessible. He wasn't available. And now he's doing interviews with Mookie Betts and with Freddie Freeman. Our friend Harold Reynolds did one for MLB Network where he's got the three of them, sat him down. He asked Mookie and Freddie what were their first impressions of Ohtani. They were laughing about that. The other day, and I don't know if this was a question that was lost in translation, but Ohtani was asked what part of his wife he likes the most. And to see the reaction of Freddie and Mookie, like, turn to him like, how are you going to answer that one, Sparky? It's been pretty cool to see, like, Ohtani, as he's joined the Dodgers, sort of blossom.
Yeah, well, look, this is a true ambassador, and you just want to see him in his comfort zone. I think in the World Baseball Classic, you kind of saw, like, a little bit of fire going head-to-head with Mike Trout. I think you saw, like, that it's there, and things get lost in translation. I mean, these players are hailing in another culture, another language, and they're still taking on this ambassadorship, and it's heavy. And so they're trying to find ways to open up that communication. And some of it is just like playing in a different environment, different culture, celebrating, being married, whatever it is. It's great to see Ohtani. And remember, Ohtani had his list of like, here are my goals. Remember, he had his whole goal list.
Yes.
I don't know where marriage was in there. It was in there. I know it was also MVP and Cy Young and all these other things, which pretty much he's pretty, you know, doing a lot of that. So now the world championship is a little bit closer than it was. And it's great for the game.
We are a little bit more than a week away from the first games here played in the United States for the regular season. What are you looking forward to the most with baseball in 2024?
I'm fired up because I look at all these teams. You know, I go do my research and I'm like, wow, there's so many good teams right now. There's teams that could just be great teams. I mean, Baltimore and Dodgers, and you just see these teams like, where is it going to come from? And so I'm looking at the schedule. I'm like, I'm looking forward to all these matchups because these teams are so well suited to create like almost like the rivalry tension, you know, Astros, Rangers, or whatever. So I'm excited to see that. You know, I feel like the game has, whether you call it parity or just like this edge of teams that could be excellent. And, you know, like I'm not handing it to the Dodgers because I'm like one injury away, one pitcher missing away, and it could be kind of last year or 2 years ago. So that's exciting because it gives all these teams a chance and they get to see some great baseball.
Yeah, I agree with you that as the spring has gone along, it's felt like that it's not as top heavy as I thought. Going into spring training, my feeling was, you know what, you got the Dodgers obviously on paper, either one or two. You got the Braves at one or two. The Phillies for me were a clear three. And then you weren't quite sure, but the Orioles have been so good this spring. You know, and having Corbin Burns and the development of young players. And, you know, I've talked about this poll of executives that I've been doing around baseball, and more than half, when I asked them the question, who's the best player under 23, are telling me Jackson Holliday, who hasn't played a day in the big leagues. Right. So like they are absolutely going to be fun to watch. A guy who is also on the ascent is Spencer Strider. He pitched on Sunday. He was dominant again.
3-2. Henderson threw the bat thinking he had a walk. He gets rung up instead. Strider goes off speed, his first strikeout. 2-2. Urias gets rung up. Spencer Strider down a little bit. 96. His second strikeout, one away. Deuces wild from Mateo. Strider comes home. And swung on a miss. Murphy holds on to it. It's another strikeout for Spencer Strider, his third of the afternoon.
So I think, Doug, that if we were to do some kind of a poll now in the aftermath of Gerrit Cole injury, I think Spencer Strider would be picked by a lot of people in baseball as the best pitcher on the planet. Tell me what you're seeing in him.
Well, I mean, I just remember covering him in the postseason last year, and, you know, the Phillies got to him eventually. But, you know, the explosiveness, you know, coming out of his hand, I mean, it's different. And you know, the movement, and he's game on. He's like high stress, like – you know, he wants to be in the game. Every time, you know, it's like a manager scared to take a guy out. That's Spencer Strider, right? He doesn't want to get out of that game, especially as he's starting to feel and still feel healthy and ready to go. And so there's scarily another gear for Spencer Strider. You know, I think he's a guy that you give him the ball and it's like, go and see what you can do. So can he be that, you know, in this culture, you know, the 7-8 inning guy, save your bullpen automatically? Can he give you 200 innings? You know, these are like the next milestones, but, you know, you talk about electricity and just fire coming out of his hand. Spencer Strider is the guy.
Yeah, he's throwing 100, 101 miles per hour, fastball top of the zone. He's shown that great slider in the past. We've seen the changeup, and this year he's focused on adding a curveball. What could that do for his repertoire, adding the fourth pitch?
Well, if you're hitting against him, you're just like, why? Why do you need this? Like, come on, man. Like, I'm trying to prepare. It's like Randy Johnson throwing a splitter mid-game. Like, what are you doing? This is unnecessary. But I like the fact that he's a perfectionist in the sense of, like, he wants to keep having his edge. And he's not going to say, well, I can just rely back on my fastball. I need to kind of mix it up and get ahead. Josh Hader, Tim Lincecum, you know, Clayton Kershaw. These are pitchers that go into the offseason and say, yeah, those are good numbers, but I got to be better. I got to be making my adjustments before they adjust to me. And I think that's someone who doesn't want to be standing still. He's got to keep moving and making sure that the opponent is guessing and never comfortable. And so I always like to see that, and we'll see how much mastery he has of it. But he, you know, it seemed like he was looking for another pitch for a little while, one for righties, one for lefties, and he started to get there.
So Joey Votto on Sunday had his first plate appearance in a major league exhibition for the Blue Jays against the Phillies. Here's what he did on the first pitch he saw against Zach Wheeler.
First pitch for Wheeler. Into the air to left center field. Pache again. It's going to be over his head, and it's off the top of the wall. Nope, now they're going to call a home run. They're going to say a home run for Joey Votto in his first spring training at bats. How about that on the first pitch he saw?
Now, Doug, there was a debate. Was the ball actually out? The Phillies argued not, but it's spring training and you're not going to do replay. Regardless, it was a beautiful swing, and I think it gives you an idea that maybe there's a lot more in Joey Votto than what a lot of people thought. I got to say, when we had him on the podcast here a couple weeks ago, I've known Joey for a long time, and he's so bright. He's always struck me as being someone who would be very good at being self-aware, of understanding when, you know what, I'm not good enough, and owning that. And he was very clear. He really has felt like, look, the last 2 years, I had a bad shoulder, and then it got fixed, and now I'm healthy, and I'm in a much better place. You know, watching what he did in some of those minor leagues games in which he, you know, took plate appearances and then took that one swing yesterday before he had to come out of the game because he rolled his ankle, I think he's going to be a plus for them this year. Tell me what you're seeing.
Joey Votto's a plus, period. I mean, you know, and I agree, Buster, like a lot of times we've had him on our podcast a few times and very introspective, recognizing where he is. He learns from other players. Like I watch video, you know, Mike Trout, he's just like a student, but he loves the game and through and through. And if he wants to bring his A game, and he's been hurt. He's been hurt. Now, when you're 40 or 41, 42, when you get older, hurt becomes a permanent state. So then you're like, I don't know, maybe I'm just not good because I'm always hurt because I'm done, right? So you always have to grapple with that. And, you know, he's like, hey, let me just find out, you know, if I can stay healthy, I still have something to offer. I still see the ball. I mean, Zach Wheeler, it's not like he's rolling the ball up there. I mean, this is Zach Wheeler. So get on his fastball. Nobody gets on his fastball, even when they know it's coming. So, hey, you know, that's a victory right there. But yeah, he's going to help the Blue Jays because it's the discipline, it's the desire to win, it's just the passion for the game, it's the calm whispers that'll say, hey, you know what? What are you looking for there? You know, that's what Joey Votto can bring. This guy could be in baseball forever. He could coach, and he's also a guy that you could see being successful in anything, just whatever he decides. I hope he goes into media because he's so fascinating and so interesting.
Yeah, you were talking about, you know, at some point with age, that's what's looked at first. I remember Derek Jeter's great quote was, hey, when you're in your 20s and you have a few bad games, then you're in a slump. And when you get to your 30s, then it's because you're old. And that's what everyone sort of views you through that prism. You know, I've certainly seen that on social media. Anytime I post anything on Joey Votto coming back, a lot of people are like, yeah, he was bad last year because he was old. Joey Votto would tell you, he was bad the last 2 years because he was not healthy. Interesting news today, on Monday morning, Susan Slusser of the San Francisco Chronicle was the first to report that Rinelle Brooks Moon is out as the public address announcer for the Giants. She's been in that job since the 2000 season. I mean, it's kind of a shocker. And according to you know, the information that's come out, there was a disagreement, it seems like, a difference of opinion on what she could be paid. And in the end, the Giants and her cutting ties. When I read this, I was like, well, how long has she been doing that again? And then I remember her announcing Barry Bonds' name, you know, back in the early 2000s. So, you know, 25 seasons or, yeah, I guess 24, 25 seasons she's been doing that.
Well, I'll tell you what. I mean, I knew her history a little bit, and then I got to meet her, and I took a picture, like, and immediately, like, had a nice conversation, just rolled up on her, just said, look, big fan. Great appreciation of your legacy, the doors you've opened, you know, her history in the area. It was a great conversation. So I kind of have that appreciation because it's such a different trajectory. And I think, you know, pioneering in so many ways. So that's a shame, like, that it could not settle in a way that, you know, really preserves someone that really loves the game and would be around it for as long as time allows her. So hopefully she ends up on her feet somewhere else. I think, you know, she will. Maybe she's at 49ers games or something. I don't know. But it's a loss. It's a loss for baseball, baseball history, the legacy on so many levels.
Yeah, and I feel like this is a situation where I suspect there's going to be a big outcry in San Francisco about this. And maybe both sides, because it was a disagreement apparently over money, both sides can get back together and maybe bridge that gap. It would be great for the Giants. It'd be great for baseball if that happened.
Yeah, no, it really would. And you know, I don't know what they're making in these positions, but you know, I imagine it's not what Ohtani's making. So it's like you can work it out, right? I mean, you can work it out, and someone who's, you know, just put in the time and the preparation and like I said, just quiet fan base, you know, nationally, but just locally, just someone who's been heroic. And I think of her voice in so many other ways, you know, like you said, milestone moments, and just, you know, I played in the early 2000s. So I was like, wait a minute, who's that? So there was Lucille. there was the DJ that played the unwrapped rap music and jazz.
Yeah.
And then there was her. So I hope she works it out. Now you're making me say, I gotta send her a note and see what's going on.
You know, it's funny too, when I think back to Barry Bonds and his legacy, as you know, the casual baseball fans had one view of him, and then Giants fans have a completely different view of it. And I think her introduction of him had a lot to do with that. Like, yeah. You know, Barry Bonds, and that never changed their enthusiasm for when he came to the plate. And I think Giants fans will always think of him as being their own. And she was, you know, part of that. So we'll see. Hopefully, as I say, they can have more conversations. All right, Doug, thanks for doing this.
Buster, always a pleasure. Look forward to the rest of the year.
For the ones who get it done, Grainger offers high-quality supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as access to product specialists who have the knowledge and experience to answer your toughest questions. Plus, their commitment to being your safety partner can help you keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code BASEBALL. That's code BASEBALL. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live. Stefania Bell is ESPN's injury expert. She's someone to reach out to anytime that we have questions about an injury. Stefania, thanks for doing this. I got your title right, yes?
Oh, yes, you did. Thanks for having me, Buster.
Yeah, and so I was around over the weekend. I saw the Yankees and, you know, asking them about Gerrit Cole and what's going to happen. And as you know, when he spoke with reporters the other day, he gave what was generally was perceived to be a positive news of his diagnosis that he got last week. What was your read on where we are with Gerrit Cole and you know, what we might expect from him this year in terms of when he might get back?
I think it's overwhelmingly positive. And I'll tell you, when you hear that the ace is not recovering as quickly as he's accustomed to and feels that he has elbow fatigue so early into spring training, you get nervous, because fatigue, it doesn't have to be pain. It can just be fatigue is often a hallmark sign of your elbow failing. You know, when we talk about elbow failing, meaning like ulnar collateral ligament, Tommy John. So that's naturally, especially with somebody who has the kind of mileage on their arm that Gerrit Cole does, you worry about that. Now, is this finally the year where he breaks down? Because he's been so durable for so long, actually. So to find out that first, you know, when he's evaluated by the Yankees, presumably Dr. Chris Ahmad, team physician, who's excellent when it comes to elbows, and there's nothing remarkable on any of the imaging, CAT scan, MRI, x-rays, and they do all that imaging, so they get a lot of different types of pictures. And then he goes for a second opinion, which is very common, by the way. Goes out to see Dr. Neil Elitrosh, who is probably the name that's most well known of people who are currently operating on baseball players. So Dr. James Andrews, now retired. And Dr. Eletrosh basically reads it the same way. And the importance, I really can't stress enough the importance of going out to see that second opinion person, Dr. Eletrosh, in person, because part of what's critical for elbow evaluation, elbow ligament evaluation, is the manual exam. So you can look at the images and you can get a decent sense of what's going on, but you have to see the player, talk to the player, then put your hands on them and you put the elbow through these very intense stress tests manually to see how the ligament responds. So clearly they went through all of that and came away with, let's leave this alone. Let's let him rest, kind of hit the reset button, ramp back up. And maybe this was just a speed bump from doing a little too much too soon early in the season.
So when Garrett met with reporters, I think it was him who made this point that there was no PRP injections at this point. What does that mean? And what do you read into that? The fact that he's told us that.
I take it really as another positive sign, because it's not uncommon when you have pitchers who are shut down because of discomfort or fatigue or something that suggests involvement of the ulnar collateral ligament, that they do a PRP injection, because the idea, it's platelet-rich plasma is what it stands for. And the idea is to use your own blood cells and the healing factors that are contained within the plasma to help stimulate a healing environment for a ligament that might be stressed. If there wasn't a need to do that, then it suggests that they didn't think there was anything really worth treating, that there may have just been some general soreness and inflammation that required rest more than anything else. So the fact that they chose to do nothing, I mean, he was right there. They could have done it. And it wouldn't have been a dissimilar downtime, because you usually want to not throw for a little bit, let the arm recover, and then you kind of work your way back up. Again, I just take it as another positive that they felt that no intervention was not only appropriate, but was the right thing to do, because certainly nobody's going to withhold treatment if they think that it's absolutely something that should happen.
So what do we know about what the actual source then of the discomfort might be, or what are we guessing potentially?
It's really hard to say, but especially because it was fatigue that he described more than actual pain, at least that's what I've heard, and difficulty in recovery. And let's face it, he's 33, if I remember correctly. You know, he's got 11 seasons of mileage on his arms with a high volume of work in most of those seasons, and your body doesn't recover as quickly as it used to. And when you're starting to ramp back up, sometimes you need an adjustment in that recovery time. Sometimes there's a little muscle imbalance. You can get minor swelling. You know, the ulnar nerve is in that area. Sometimes you can get a little nerve irritation that can factor in. But there's really nothing to pinpoint, because we don't have enough information to, you know, lay the blame on one particular thing. But it sounds like it's something that rest and kind of going a little slower, maybe the way that he recovers as he's ramping back up is addressed a little bit differently. There's all kinds of things you can tweak in that program to get you back on track. But I would expect in a 4 to 6 week period, he should be back to working where they have a pretty good idea of what's going to happen next.
So I've always sort of worked under the premise of, when we get into these injury situations, that we have to do the best we can with the information that the players give us or the agent gives us. In this case, as far as I can tell, all the information has come through either Garrett or his agent. And look, I think players should be able to release publicly what they want to release publicly. That's their legal right. And at Absolutely. The same time, I'm not legally required to believe everything that I'm told. Have you seen been aware of situations in the time of your reporting where what a player or an agent said publicly is very different than what the actual fact is?
Oh, definitely. And I would say, and this is across all sports too, it's not unique to baseball. And you always have to understand the context of, you know, where the player is with their contract, the relationship with their team, where all of these things can be factors. And we're smart to keep all of that in mind, because nothing happens in isolation. And that being said, I can't really recall maybe one or two instances of outright fib telling.
The phrase I've used through the years is strategic deception, because I don't want to say the word lie. Strategic deception might be a good way to put it.
Yes. And I also think typically what I see, if I'm being honest, is underreporting of information. So, for example, they might say that they had, I don't know, I see it a lot. I'm thinking of football because that's just what's coming into my mind right now. But a knee ligament injury, and maybe they just report one ligament, but they don't tell you all the other stuff. There's a secondary ligament. There's also some, you know, tendonitis going on, blah, blah, blah. So they don't give you the whole picture. They give you this little sliver of the picture. And I think that's pretty common, actually, in sports. Probably more common than we get that underreporting, or something just gets boiled down to one label. It's this ligament. And actually, the problem is a little bit different. So I don't think we ever have, I don't think we can ever be sure that we have the full and complete picture. But, you know, you take your clues from context, as I know you know very, very well. So, you know, for example, would a player who was at risk of having Tommy John surgery be like, say they were fine and there was nothing on, no findings on imaging and nothing? It's hard to make that leap, you know, that it would be that extreme. But I would also say, and this is totally true, you have somebody who's pitched that many seasons, that many innings in the big leagues, would you expect their ligament to be pristine, or would you expect it to show some normal wear and tear? You know, there's normal age-related changes that happen with athletes that are not problematic until they are, you know what I mean? So I think there's things like that where we may not get all of the information, but it doesn't mean anyone's not telling the truth.
Right. I've had general managers, I remember specifically one saying to me, look, most of the time we tell you guys inflammation, which isn't really telling you anything. And we're not, we're telling you about a symptom. We're not really telling you what the problem is. And so when it, you know, when stories like this are reported, it really does need to be, according to Garrett Cole, this is what his doctor said, versus saying it empirically. It's important. And it's important to note that, you know, this is a big year for him contractually, where he has this opt out at the end of the contract and he can get a $36 million option. So there is a fine dance that he's doing with the Yankees now about all this. And, you know, and we'll see what happens in the end. It's all probably going to come down to what he can do on the field and if he could stay healthy. So,
yeah. And I hope for his sake. I mean, I look at someone like him who has done so well to stay healthy across the course of his career. And I feel like he deserves to be able to carry that through, you know, and be rewarded on the other side, because it's so hard in baseball. Do you find me somebody with that volume of work who hasn't had Tommy John surgery? It's almost impossible. And to his credit, I think I was looking back over his injury history. I think at one point, it might have been 2016, he had some elbow soreness or elbow inflammation. And, you know, if we were looking, trying to nitpick and look in his history and say, well, did he have something in his elbow before? It's 2024. I mean, 2016 is a long time ago, so it's hard to necessarily connect the two. I mean, he showed that when he had this slight issue before, he came back and pitched, you know, another 7 years on top of it with no issues. So I hope for his sake that it's all, this all ends well and he can come back and be atop the rotation and be the same guy that he was before.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. He's a great pro. And to, you know, you're talking about the sort of the long-standing effects of pitching. In my time covering baseball, I've seen two former pitchers throw batting practice in retirement. That's how bad, you know, it can be with the mileage and the effect on these guys.
And the other thing is, just one other thing I'd like to say, which is all of these things can be true, that he can be fine. This can be just a bump in the road, that there was nothing really remarkable, nothing that warranted any kind of intervention. And he could still, 8 weeks from now, be back pitching and have a failure of his elbow ligament. That also happens, you know, so there's no,
yes.
I think if he were to, let's hope not, but if something catastrophic were to happen with his elbow, I would hope that people wouldn't automatically assume, oh,
he was lying.
They weren't being factual about, right, exactly, because we also know it can happen that way as well. So if anyone had a crystal ball, we would love to use it. But unfortunately, I haven't seen that yet.
All right, Stefania. Thank you so much. It was great talking with you.
Same. Thanks for having me. 0096.
This is The Numbers Game with Sarah Langs.
Sarah Langs is a reporter and producer for MLB.com. Sarah, how are you doing this week?
I'm doing great, Lester. How are you?
I'm doing great. I got to say, it's on the record. Anybody listened to a podcast last week, our final podcast at the end of last week, knows that I asked you very specifically if there was any news coming out about you. Is there a scholarship that was being named your honor? Is there some effort being done with you? Is something happening? And you're like, no. I mean, you flat out denied it. It was very Garrett Cole of you to do that, right? You know, I mean, specific answer. And then within 3 hours, it's like, Sarah Langs is on MLB The Show. And my son Jake is like, what are you, an idiot? You didn't know she's on MLB The Show? And I said, I asked her directly that question. What happened?
The timing was impeccable. I was laughing so hard. The moment people started tweeting about it and became public out there, the first thing I thought of was, oh my gosh, I just accidentally lied to Buster's face. It was so funny at the time. I taped that a while back, and I'm not a huge gamer, so I didn't know the exact timeline of when it would be coming out. But the baseball gods clearly wanted to get at me by having it come out that day.
It was released at midnight, and Jake was so fired up about it. And then it happened, and he was laughing at me. He was just laughing at me. All right. I've got a great question for you after we do the numbers game today, but what do you got?
Number three is one. So on Monday, White Sox manager Pedro Grifol named Garrett Crochet the team's opening day starter. They initially said that Dylan Cease would be starting opening day, but of course then he got traded. And it's a very exciting opportunity for Crochet, who they've been working on turning into a starter. However, the one is for the fact that this will be the first start of his major league career. All of his other major league appearances have been out of the bullpen. He will be the ninth pitcher in the last 110 years to make his first career start on opening day. Tanner Shepherd did it for the Rangers back in 2014. Before that, you have to go back to Fernando Valenzuela in 1981. And prior to that, we're in the 40s and before. Richard Rowe in 1944, Algar Hauser 1943, Ren Evans 1939, Jim Bagby 1938, Lefty Grove in 1925, and Eddie Ayers in 1920.
Number two is three.
So I think I have to stop even giving the disclaimer that I'm not going to talk about spring stats because there have been enough of them. I found interesting that here I am with another. So on Sunday, Kyle Sowers of the Orioles hit 3 home runs. And anyone who has watched spring training games knows that 3 home runs are not common because often guys aren't getting enough at bats in the game to be able to hit 3. And that's just not something we see often. So if spring stats back to 2006, and that time is the 12th 3-homer game, and the first since the recently retired Mike Zunino in March of 2018. And he would have gotten in bat in the 9th inning of the game, but he got pinch hit for it.
Number one is zero.
So, I feel like I've talked about Spencer Strider a couple of times already this spring, and I feel like we're going to be talking about him a lot during the season. The zero is for the fact that so far this spring, He's yet to allow any runs at all. He's thrown 18 and two-thirds innings, not a single run. I'm going to assume he has one more spring start left, but something to keep an eye on is that only two pitchers since at least 06 have gone an entire spring without allowing a run and throwing at least as many innings as he has thrown so far. And it was Kershaw. 2018, he threw 21 third innings, and Verlander in 2014, who threw 20 innings. So again, spring stats, they matter, they show a thing, anything not a waste, but when Spencer Strider does not allow a run, that seems to match up.
Yeah, I agree with you. There's sometimes when spring training stats are a great barometer for kind of how a player is doing, how a player is feeling. And this is one of those cases because it's clear Spencer Strider, after back-to-back years of feeling disappointed about his postseason, came into this year incredibly motivated, added that curveball. And I knew you were going to have a Spencer Strider number today. I just knew that. I just don't know if you're going to be honored with some scholarship or something like that. That's I'm trying to keep up with that. I know this about you, too. You are a night owl. And these first two games in the regular season are going to be start at 5:30 a.m. Eastern time. What's your regimen going to be, Sarah, to listen to our friends Carl Ravitch and Eduardo Perez on ESPN?
Well, not to listen to. I work these games. I work behind the scenes. I'll be doing talent stats for them, even though I'm so far away from where they are.
I didn't know you were doing stats for them.
Yeah,
for those two games.
I am.
How? What are you? Are you going to stay up late, or are you going to get up early?
I'm going to try to get up early. I'm going to try to go to bed early for me on Tuesday night, and then wake up early on Wednesday, and then do the same thing. But I'm also definitely be going back to sleep after the game as well.
Man, are you a coffee drinker?
I'm not.
You know, getting up on the farm as a kid, what got me going was my stepfather, Ed, would lean up and he would yell through a heat duct, which was right next to the bed where I would sleep. And it would be like, Buster, get up. And I knew I had to be there in 10 minutes. And man, that is something that stuck with me my whole life. So maybe I'll have Ed tape something for you.
Oh my goodness. I mean, we're going to need all the help we can get, but at least it's for baseball. I mean, as I've said, the only thing I will ever wake up this early for is something baseball related. So I'm very, very excited.
All right, Sarah. Just for the record, are we going to hear anything about us, anything honoring you here in the next 48 hours? Just give us a heads up.
Nothing that I'm aware of, I promise. I
See,
swear.
That is such a general manager cop-out. Like, he is our opening day starter, which is, you know, it was a very Clinton-esque use of language there. So I appreciate that. Sarah, thanks for doing this.
Thanks so much for having me, Buster.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish.
Yes, the clutch hits, the strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, 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 with nothing on your roof. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Baseball Tonight. 2024 team preview. Miami Marlins. Machinations.
The Marlins made the playoffs last year for the first time in a 162-game regular season since 2003. And yet they lost general manager Kim Ng, who wouldn't accept a demotion to the number two spot in their baseball operations. Peter Bendix came over from the Tampa Bay Rays to run the front office. The Marlins didn't do a lot to change the makeup of the team that Ng put together, but they did sign shortstop Tim Anderson, giving him a one-year deal to be their shortstop. There is already speculation among rival execs that the Marlins might wind up trading off assets like left-hander Jesus Luzardo, who will be under team control for three more seasons and will become much more expensive as he goes through arbitration.
The weakest link.
If the Marlins are going to be relevant again, their defense must be solid, and they don't have a lot of plus defenders. Infielder Josh Bell, Arise, Anderson, and Jake Berger all scored below average in advanced metrics last year, and Jazz Chisholm was a minus -9 in defensive runs saved in 2023 while playing center field.
A guy to watch.
It seems like every May or June, we have a discussion about whether or not Luis Arise might have a shot at hitting 400 for a full season, and then his numbers sink in the second half. He batted .354 with 30 doubles and 10 homers last year. Still, his style is so unusual in this era. Arise had 617 plate appearances in 2023 and accumulated more walks, 35, than strikeouts, 34. His batting average with two strikes was .314 with a .354 on base percentage.
Win projection.
Pecota is not kind to the Marlins, predicting a decline to 79.7 wins. Sarah Lang says 78 wins. Hembo says 74. I've got them at 75 and executing a midseason sell-off.
Gabby Sanchez is an analyst on Marlins broadcast, and of course you remember him from his 7 years in the big leagues. Gabby, how you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm doing great. The Marlins, last year they shocked everybody with their ascension into the postseason, but so much has changed for this team since last fall. We'll start with this. Sandy Alcantara had Tommy John surgery. Yuri Perez is having some elbow issues. At the moment, in your eyes, what's the state of their rotation?
Yeah, well, you look at, you know, a guy like Braxton Garrett. He is also getting to the party a little bit late. He was having some issues. So he's also not going to be ready for the start of the season. Edward Cabrera, another guy who they looked at with Sandy being gone. You know, electric stuff, 96, 97 miles an hour with a sinker, a power changeup that he was throwing at 95. He also looks like he's going to start on that IL. So right now, when you're looking at the rotation, the Marlins, there is a possibility where they will have four lefties starting in their rotation. The fifth one is still up for grabs at this point. But you have guys like Jesus Luzardo, who is a big-time lefty. He's going to take it opening day. He was the number two last year. A phenomenal job. They're looking for him to kind of grow, maybe throwing some more innings, getting some more work done. Trevor Rogers, have to remember a couple of years ago when he jumped out into the scene. He was an all-star his first year. And then injuries have, you know, really hurt him. He looks really healthy this spring. He's been throwing the ball exceptionally well. You have another guy, Ryan Weathers, younger. He added a couple pitches. He's been throwing the ball really well. And then A.J. Puck. Last year, he was in the bullpen. He has been a starter before, but when they got him last year, he was the closer to start off for the Marlins. They moved him into the starting rotation as well because they thought that he has a lot more to offer. He's been 96, 97 in spring. The firepower is there in that starting rotation, and that's what helped them last year. You look at their games last year, it was really pitching heavy, bullpen heavy, playing good defense, winning run-run games, which is what got them to the playoffs and what got them into a winning season. They're going to basically have to do the same thing again. They do have hitters. They have guys that can hit it out. But I think they're going to be basically relying on that starting pitching staff. And then hopefully the guys like Edward Cabrera are healthy, are able to come back. Braxton Garrett is able to come back. And then that will give you a lot more length with your starting rotation.
So tell me about Lizardo in your eyes, what needs to happen next? Because I do think he's someone who is going to be talked a lot about this season, not only because of what he does with the Marlins, but maybe other teams calling them up and saying, look, are you willing to talk about him in trade? What does Lizardo need to do in his development?
For me, he added a curveball because he wanted to see a difference in speed variations because he does have a hard slider. It used to be more of a slurve. Mel Sotomayor Jr. got him a little bit on top of it, so now it's a truer slider, and it's hard. So he wanted to get a wrinkle that was a 12 to 6, which he has been throwing at spring, and it has been effective. The last outing that he just finished having, I think it was yesterday, in the minor league side, they said that that was the best that he's, you know, pitched so far this spring. For me, it's going to be, can he be that frontline starter? Can he go into that seventh inning, eighth inning consistently throughout the year? That is what his goal is. I talked to him earlier this spring, and I said, okay, what are your goals? Because last year you surpassed the 200 innings. That's what you want to do. And his big thing is, I want to get into that seventh, eighth inning. I want to throw complete games. I believe that he has the ability and the stuff to be able to do it. He does strike out a lot of guys, which means that that pitch count will go up because he's throwing the extra pitches. But he also told me, too, learning from Sandy Alcantara, where, hey, you don't have to strike everybody out. Early contact is good for your pitching because that will keep the pitch count down. So you want those early soft contacts. So, and I think that's something that he wants to work on as well, to be able to keep that pitch count down to get into the later innings.
So we had ESPN last week release its top 100 players. Luis Arraez was somewhere around 42. And I did a story where I went around and I talked to players about the rankings, and they picked the numbers apart and, hey, you guys should have had this guy higher, that sort of thing. I thought when I looked at the list that we had Arraez too high because, for me, it doesn't hit a lot of home runs. The defense has been somewhat questionable. And the feedback that I was getting from players was, you guys should have had Arraez higher. Like, they were absolutely backing him. As a great hitter yourself, how would you describe what really distinguishes him beyond the ball to bat skills?
For me, like, if I can pick a player that looks the most like Tony Gwynn, it's Luis Arraez. What he is able to do with his barrel manipulation, I have never seen other than a Tony Gwynn type of player. He's able to go from line to line. It doesn't matter where you throw the pitch. It can be in off the plate, and he'll smack a double down that left field line. I get where you're saying. You know, the power is not there. He'll hit his home runs, but it's not going to be a big production with power guy. But he just gets on base. He has a knack for getting the big hit. You talk about defensively, I mean, last you looked at it, he only had four errors. He had a 992 fielding percentage. So defensively, he does get to the ball and he makes the play. It's not his glaring, but I feel like he's flying under the radar where guys aren't seeing him as a very good second baseman, and he has played really good second base. But for me, the ability for him to be able to manipulate the bat head at a fastball that's coming in at 97 miles an hour and hit it wherever he wants. He scans the field prior to the pitch and goes, that's where the opening is, and then he hits it right to that spot. It's incredible what he's able to do.
So you are absolutely preaching to the choir here. I covered Tony Gwynn for 3 years, and everything you're talking about, I can remember, and I agree with you. He reminds me a lot of Tony, and I wonder, as what happened with Tony later in his career, that Arraez is going to look for more and more spots to take a big swing. You know, Tony, especially with his understanding of pitchers, would start to do that, and maybe Arraez will start to do that as well. So there are times when, you know, as a member of the media, you have a conversation with a manager and you walk away and go, wow, okay, that guy is a frontline, one of the best managers that I've talked to. I felt that way. I remember getting to know Alex Cora. I think the same thing with Skip Schumacher. I think even after 1 year, I think of him as being a managerial superstar who's going to be in that position for a long time. Tell me what you've seen in him in his time as their manager.
One, it's no nonsense, which I love for a manager, but he's still a player's manager. So he expects what he's giving to you for you to return that to him. He's going to give you everything that he got. He wants you to do the same. One of the things that I like most about him is he doesn't let things snowball. If you made a mistake in the outfield or in the infield, they will go right away and tell you. Where other managers, you would see, you know, hey, I'll tell them after the game or maybe the next day, we're stretching, I'll go walk up, hey, remember this ball that they hit to left field? And, you know, instead of cutting the ball and throwing it to third, you air-mailed it to home, and that guy, you know, came around. Well, he will tell you right then and there during the game, they will go and get the player and say, hey, this is what happened, because he doesn't want it to happen again in that same game. And I feel like the players respect him for that. He doesn't do it in a bad way. He speaks to you like a man. And I think that these players have basically are going all in with him. They understand that he's there for their best needs, and he's going to do everything possible to help them. And in return, they do the same. And that's what you've kind of seen with this family-building team that they have there in Miami, where he knows how to go to guys, certain guys, where he's able to talk to, you know, how he's able to motivate them. He does a really good job. And just like you said, last year, nobody was expecting the Marlins to do what they were doing. The only ones that expected it were the coaching staff and the players themselves. And that's because, you know, Skip would come out, and when he speaks, everybody's listening and everybody's paying attention and everybody's on the same page.
Last one for you. Tim Anderson is entering what is going to be a big year for him. He's essentially looking to reestablish himself before he becomes a free agent next fall. What have you seen in him this spring?
What I'm hearing from the players is that he's a great guy, great team guy. He is quiet. And then when he steps onto that field, he is ready to go. And he has that fireness in him. You look at last year, and everybody was talking about how much of a down year it was. And it was like, wait, I mean, he hit 242. I've seen worse years from guys, and prior 4 years other than that, he was hitting 300 and above. I think I averaged out the 4 years prior to the last year that he just finished having, where he averaged like a 318 average, over 20 doubles, and over about 12 or 13 home runs. If he can get back to that, that gives you an added guy in a lineup where last year, where you looked where we were hurting, and it was in that shortstop position, it was in that catching position, especially on the offensive side. If he is able to come up and just do kind of what he was doing, what his average was, because it is who he was, it's going to be a big boost. And I see him working extremely hard. The bat speed is still there. It's quick and short to the ball. He's been playing really good defense at shortstop. And I think the biggest thing is he's gelling really well with all the other players.
Yeah, Joe McEwing has stories about Tim and how he's like, yeah, just give me more information. Let's go to work. Let's do more. And so it sounds like his first days with the Marlins are along those lines. Gabby, thanks for doing this.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Baseball Tonight, 2024 Team Preview, the Cleveland Guardians, machinations.
In the 11 seasons under Terry Francona, the Guardians competed just about every year for the American League Central title. But they have a new manager now in Stephen Vogt.
The foundation.
Year after year, the Guardians produce good pitching staffs, and this year probably won't be any different with Tanner Bibee, Shane Bieber, Tristan McKenzie, Gavin Williams, and Logan Allen, and Emmanuel Clase working at the back end of the bullpen.
The weakest link.
Last year, the Braves led the majors in homers with 307. The Nationals finished 29th with less than half of what Atlanta generated at 151. The Guardians, by comparison, hit only 124 homers, winding up dead last in that number in the majors. And they finished 27th in runs. They really didn't upgrade their power during the winter.
Win projection.
Sarah Lang says the Guardians taking a 6-win jump over last year to 82. I'm not totally on board with that. I've got them at 78. Hembo says 77. Pecota is much more positive. They've got Cleveland at 83.6 wins. Mandy Bell covers the Cleveland Guardians for MLB.com, and she also, as everybody knows, is a close friend of Sarah Lang. So, Mandy, I'm going to recruit you with this effort, okay, when it comes to Sarah. It feels like whenever she comes on the podcast, you know, I'll ask her, you know, have conversations about what she's doing, what she's working on, and within hours after the podcast taping is over, something breaks on the internet that like this award's been given to her, the scholarship has happened. And I specifically asked her last Thursday, Sarah, do we need to know anything about what's going on with you? And she's like, no. And within hours, like 3 or 4 hours, we find out that she's on MLB The Show as one of the voices. Listen, what can we do?
Listen, I didn't even know. Like, I didn't know until she tweeted. And I'm like, how do you do this? Why do you do this? How do you keep everything so quiet? And she's just like, I don't know. It's just something. I'm like, no, it's not something. That's huge. That's awesome. So I don't know. There's no way to fix it. Somehow there's going to be more things that keep coming out and she's just going to try to hide from it. I don't know. I don't know how to fix that.
Man, it's so annoying. You know? I'm like, come on, Sarah, let's go.
I've been trying for so long. Trust me.
All right. What's the state of the Guardians rotation as we near the start of the season?
Okay. It's pretty much okay. Let's just at least start there. But they did have some hiccups here in the last few weeks. Gavin Williams, who was supposed to be part of this rotation, has been dealing with some elbow discomfort, but it's not something that they're too alarmed about. All the scans came back okay. He just made an awkward throw during like a weighted ball program. And it's just something that they're trying to be overly cautious about. So they will have to find a replacement for him going into the year for maybe the first few weeks, but they think that he'll be able to get built up pretty quickly and join back in. So as long as that's it, this should still be the biggest strength that they have, with Shane Bieber, Tristan McKenzie, Tanner Bibee, and Logan Allen being the other four that will eventually be paired with Gavin Williams as well when he's back. So this should be the biggest area of strength of this roster.
So along those lines, you mentioned Bieber, and it was interesting during the winter when there was talks about whether or not Cleveland might float him out in trade discussions. The feedback I got back from other teams was, nope, there's too much to be scared about, too much to be concerned about. And their feeling is he needs to go out and prove himself, reprove himself essentially in 2024. How's he feeling? How does he look?
He looks great. He looks really excellent, actually. He went to Driveline over the offseason with the goal of trying to get some of that velocity back that he had lost over the last few years. And it seems like so far that's back. He's been hitting 94 pretty consistently on the radar gun. Definitely sitting at least 93, which, okay, maybe in the big picture doesn't sound like a lot, but whenever he was dipping down to 90, 91, maybe 92 on a good day, that's a big difference still. And his curveball is starting to play up like it did in 2020. And he was nearly untouchable that whole year. Granted, it was a short season and there was a lot of weird things about that year, but still he was as dominant as you could have ever imagined a pitcher being. And he's starting to show flashbacks of that. And I think that if you're going into another season with Shane Bieber as your ace, you can't ask for much more than him looking like the 2020 version of himself.
So when I get asked about Cleveland and whether or not they're going to trade Francisco Lindor or Cliff Lee or CC Sabathia, my response is they're always going to be in listening mode. Mm-hmm. They're always going to consider where they are, what the potential return is. What's your read on the chances that Bieber finishes the year with this team?
I mean, it all depends on if he stays healthy, and it depends on what their goals are this year. And I think they're still trying to figure out what their identity is going to be, how successful they can be. There's a lot of question marks. And when you're this young, you have really no idea what you're going to be until the season starts. And if somehow they are in a position here where they can run away with the division by the time July runs around, maybe they do just finally let someone walk into free agency, a pitcher specifically. But if they're in a position where maybe this isn't the year and you could really capitalize on giving him away to a team that could use a rental and you'd trade him off, I wouldn't be surprised if that's the move. So right now, my gut feeling is that he would be traded in July, assuming he stays healthy, which after the last few years is a big assumption. But if he stays healthy and he looks the way he does right now, it's hard to imagine they wouldn't capitalize on that in July. But if they want to try to make a run this year, maybe that we finally see them let a starting pitcher who's going into free agency just walk.
Where are the flickers of hope about more power being generated by this lineup? As you know, I detailed the numbers before you came on about how the Nationals were 29th and they had fewer than 50% of fewer than half of the home runs that the Braves hit. And as you know, the Guardians are way below the Nationals. So who are the players that maybe represent some hope in their evolution?
Definitely Jose Ramirez and Josh Naylor, but that's no different than what they've had in the past. So right. Taking that step up is going to be, they're going to need to turn to some of these younger guys. They're going to need Bo Naylor, their catcher, who's in his first full season now, to use some of the confidence that he's built up, getting some experience last year, and try to translate that into some more comfort at the plate, which then will result in more power. I think that there is some in there, but it's going to be once they get starting to get into their minor league system. As we're recording this right now on Monday, they just sent down Kyle Manzardo, who was a non-roster invite. It wasn't someone that was necessarily like a lock to make this team, but he's someone that they're looking for to get that power from eventually when he gets called up. He will be called up this year at some point. It's just a matter of when. And I think once we start getting into that type of player is whenever they'll start to get a little bit more help. But for now, it's pretty much status quo unless someone can really settle in a little bit more, develop just more, because this is such a young roster and it has been the last few years.
Compare, contrast, and I know you've had answered this question before the spring, what you've seen in the camp this year under Stephen Vogt in his first year as manager versus what it was like under Terry Francona.
A lot of it is pretty similar. I think they have a lot of similar personalities, like traits, I should say. Stephen Vogt is very self-deprecating, and that we've become so accustomed to with Terry Francona. The way that they go about things, there's always sarcasm. They're both super approachable. And so they relate to everybody in the room. There's a lot of things that are similar, but it does seem like Vogt's age maybe might make this a little bit different, especially with a young roster. He seems like, this is a weird way to put it, and sorry, Tito, in advance, but maybe there's an uncle in the room rather than more of a grandpa. Sorry, Tito, and again. But it just seems like there's maybe that a better connection there, just because it seems like he's a little bit more in touch with how today's guys are working. And maybe there's a different type of camaraderie. There's always been a camaraderie, but it just seems like there's maybe a different type. There's a little bit more youthfulness in the room. And just maybe that connection is just a little bit different. And maybe different is good. Maybe different is bad. We won't know until the season gets underway. But I think that less of that age gap there might mean that there's a close-knitness that maybe was a little bit different in years past.
And Manny, I totally get what you're talking about. You know, I've gone back and spoken to my old high school for years. And then about 5 or 6 years ago, I began to feel that. And so, you know, I reached out to go speak at my old high school with me alongside to make me more relevant. It was Sarah.
She can make anyone.
You know, I knew that they could relate to her a lot better than they could to me.
It's smart. At least you understood that and you brought her along. I'm impressed.
All right, Manny, thanks for doing this.
Yeah, thanks, Buster.
Bleacher Tweets are brought to you by DirecTV. Get the best of live sports and streaming together. No satellite dish required. Now stream DirecTV satellite free.
Bleacher Tweets.
So it's been pretty fun going through these voicemails. Thanks to everyone for calling in. Buster, I have two Bleacher Tweets for you today. Here's the first one.
Hey, guys. This is Landon from Atlanta. Buster, last podcast you mentioned that the Dylan Cease trade, the White Sox did really well with it being headlined with Drew Thorpe, I believe, prospect around number 85, currently on MLB.com. I was wondering your thoughts about, I believe, prospect capital has really increased in value over the last couple of years, because it wasn't that long ago that at the deadline, the Cubs gave up Gleyber Torres, around a top 15, top 10 prospect, to the Yankees for a half season of Chapman. And around the same time, the Athletics gave up Addison Russell for a half year of Jeff Samardzija and Jay Hamill, I believe. Would love to hear your thoughts on the rising stock of prospects. Thank you.
That is a great question, and it's a great observation that is absolutely dead on. You know, you think back at just a few years ago that the Mets got Javier Baez, a half season of him, for Pete Crow Armstrong, who was a top pick, and now he's going to wind up playing the outfield for the Cubs. That is a trade that no team would make these days. Like, they value prospects so much more, you know, higher. And so the idea that, you know, Dylan Cease, who might be the best available starting pitcher in the market, would get at the high end, the fifth best prospect in the Padres organization might strike casual fans as being like, wow, that doesn't make any sense. Shouldn't you get the number one, number two type prospects? That's not how teams are viewing it. So your observation is 100% dead on.
And here's the next one.
Hi, this is Joshua Smith from Southern California. Last year when Madison Bumgarner was released by the Diamondbacks, you hypothesized that he would take a little break and then come back. Do you have any news on whether or not he's getting any traction with any team? Thanks.
As far as I know, he's had no traction with any team. I know there was some interest from the Rangers in having a conversation with him, but as far as I know, that hasn't gone anywhere. It would not surprise me at all if Madison disappeared down a rabbit hole and somewhere in some fashion, in some field someplace, he's wrestling a cow. He's preparing for his next rodeo appearance or something like that. And then there'll be a time when he's going to be asked to throw out a first pitch at a Giants game, and he'll come back and he'll throw 90 miles an hour. It's been a surprise that he has not been in camp this year, that's for sure.
Thanks to everyone for reaching out. If you would like to ask a question yourself, call us at 406-404-8460 or tweet us.
Yeah, Adrian, I don't know if you know the backstory of Madison Bumgarner. While he was with the team with the Giants, he was competing in rodeo competition under a pseudonym.
What was the pseudonym?
I can't remember, but it was one of those where it made complete sense. It was the strangest story that made complete sense, you know?
Of course.
Because that was just his personality, and he felt like nothing could hurt him.
And I love that.
I think that included, Texas Longhorns or whatever he was wrestling. All right, that's it for today. My thanks to Adrian, to Mandy Bell, to Gabby Sanchez, Doug Glanville, Stefania, Sarah Langs. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something we need to fight against every single day.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.